Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 21st of April, these are our main stories. The US House of Representatives has approved a much-delayed multi-billion dollar package of military aid for Ukraine. In a rare show of bipartisanship, Democrats and moderate Republicans saw off the opposition of the far right. The outcome has been welcomed by President Zelensky, who said it makes both Ukraine and the US stronger. Dozens of people have drowned when a boat carrying mourners to a funeral capsized in the Central African Republic. In Spain's Canary Islands, thousands of people have joined protests against what they say are unsustainable levels of mass tourism. Also in this podcast...
A big male officer kicked me very hard in the back. Later, I began urinating blood. The doctor told me my kidney was partly torn. The court fined me $50.
Inside Iran, the government has launched a new crackdown on women. So, Ukraine has finally got its wish. The $61 billion military aid package from the United States that President Zelensky so desperately wanted. Following months of delays by Republicans in the House of Representatives, the House has now finally agreed the aid. The bill now goes to the Senate and then President Biden. Can it make any difference on the battlefield? President Zelensky seems to think so.
Today we received a decision, which we expected.
Today, we received the decision we expected, the package of American support that we fought so hard for. And it's a very significant package that will be felt by our soldiers on the front line, as well as by our towns and villages that are suffering from Russian terror. Today, the US House of Representatives voted. Thank you to everyone for helping to save lives.
The delay in agreeing an aid package has allowed the Russian military to advance further into Ukrainian territory. Before the vote on Saturday, there were fierce arguments for and against sending aid to Ukraine, especially from Republicans who support Donald Trump. One of them, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, said America shouldn't be sending billions of dollars overseas to fund wars in far-off countries.
You see, the United States taxpayer has already sent $113 billion to Ukraine, and a lot of that money is unaccounted for. This is a continuance of a sick business model that the American government continues.
But Democrats and some Republicans united to defeat such arguments. President Biden said they had come together to answer history's call, which he said he had fought for months to secure. I heard more from our Washington correspondent, Will Vernon.
Well, this bill has already had quite a long life, hasn't it? President Biden first introduced it to Congress exactly 6 months ago today. Back then, it was part of a package which also included measures to send aid to Israel and Taiwan, and now those have all been split up into separate bills. But the reason that this has been such a long time coming is firstly because the Republican Party is becoming more isolationist. Many lawmakers are sceptical about sending billions of dollars to Ukraine. Even the Speaker, Mike Johnson, he was a Ukraine sceptic too. The other reason that this bill has been stuck is because many Democrats were unhappy with the Israel part of it. They didn't want aid being granted to the Israelis due to the conduct of the war in Gaza. And some hardline Republicans even threatened to oust Mr. Johnson as Speaker if he brought the Ukraine bill specifically to the floor of Congress. So he's been pretty reluctant to do so. But it seems that in the last few weeks, something has changed. Mr. Johnson's been under an awful lot of pressure from the White House, from the Ukrainians and their supporters in Washington. And what we understand is that he had a change of heart. He became susceptible to these arguments that by not working to approve this aid, to get it on the floor of the House, he would find himself on the wrong side of history, helping Vladimir Putin. obviously most people here see Mr. Putin as an enemy of America. So it seems he had a change of heart, and eventually the bill was brought.
So what did President Biden say, and when will this aid start arriving?
Mr. Biden issued a statement after that historic vote, thanking members of Congress for passing what he called urgently needed legislation, and he urged the Senate to quickly approve it, which they almost certainly will, probably in the next few days, maybe on Tuesday. After that, it will go to Mr. Biden's desk and he will sign it. As soon as that happens, the weapons supplies can begin almost immediately, according to the Pentagon. They said they've got all these deliveries packed up, basically prepared and ready to go, ready to be sent off to the front lines. We also had a statement from the US Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin. He said, I welcome the passage of the critical National Security Supplemental, which will allow the Department of Defense to surge life-saving security assistance to help Ukraine defend itself from Russia's aggression.
Will Vernon. Russia has condemned the package, saying it would further ruin Ukraine and lead to more deaths. Oleksandr Mereshko is MP for Ukraine's governing Servant of the People Party and head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in Parliament. He spoke to my colleague Lise Doucette.
We feel great relief, and the truth is that psychologically, politically, it's a truly historic decision, which can be compared only to the land lease given to the UK during the Second World War. And, you know, it gives us hope, and this package and military aid will definitely save lots of lives of our civilians and our soldiers. It's a tremendously important historic decision for us.
So we heard that they're expecting the munitions, the air defenses, the other military supplies to be on their way to Ukraine shortly. In fact, there's some reports they've been pre-positioned. Will they go directly to the battlefield? Will there be an immediate impact?
Our president has already said today that the results of this decision will be felt really soon by civilians and by our army. So I assume that these weapons, it's been in the process or has already been prepared, and soon it will reach our army, it will reach frontline, and we'll see concrete results on the battlefield.
And I was in Ukraine in February, where everyone I met, whether people in coffee shops or national security advisors, they all were really anxious about this money and why it was being held up. Then you were losing on the front lines. What is the situation now?
The situation is difficult, but at the same time, I'm sure that, you know, we have this return of the hope, and we feel that we were not left alone. It gives us strength, it gives us courage and resolve to continue to fight, and I'm sure that the situation at the front will soon change in our favor.
Oleksandr Mereshko speaking to Lise Doucette. I spoke to our correspondent James Waterhouse, who's in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
I think it's the ammunition issue which is most pressing for Ukraine, because from the moment Western help got bogged down, well, US help got bogged down with this disagreement in Washington 6 months ago, we've seen Ukrainian soldiers have to ration artillery shells and other forms of ammunition. They've made fewer long-range missile strikes in areas close to the front line. And it's what that has caused which is significant for Ukraine, where Russia has used its size to take hundreds of square kilometres. Russia has enjoyed air superiority close to the front lines, which has allowed it to take towns like Avdiivka, an approach on another small town called Chazovyar, which is strategically significant because of it being a major transport hub. And this war tends to have a domino effect when you're talking about static front lines. If Russia has momentum, you find yourself with Ukrainian cities looking increasingly perilous. So what this offering from America does is it offers the ammunition I mentioned, it also offers air defence systems as Russia continues to target Ukrainian cities. And it will include armoured vehicles which allow Ukraine to sort of keep up the fight on the front line. But we're not talking about Ukraine suddenly being able to change the tide and liberate territory. It just keeps Ukraine in the fight and, crucially, the negotiating table at bay.
So what is the latest on the fighting, James?
Well, at the moment, Russian forces are knocking on the door of Chazovyar. We have the head of the armed forces, Oleksandr Syrsky, warning that the town could fall soon. And you have cities like Kupiansk in the northeast, Kostantinivka in the east, Kramatorsk, cities that have been got used to living near the war but bracing themselves for what might be coming over the horizon because they know the Russian playbook here. When they get near, they start to shell entire cities constantly, forcing most of their population to flee. And then you end up in a scenario, as with Bakhmut, as with Avdiivka, where you have a Russian flag planted in an area that has pretty much been reduced to rubble. And it is something that Russia continually calls liberation. So this is the state of things in the east. You're having Ukraine enjoy some successes with drone strikes inside Russia itself on energy infrastructure as well as across Crimea. But the problem for Ukraine is this strategy feeds into the long game, whereas the reason why this Western help has taken so long to arrive from America is because it hasn't been able to deliver progress in the short term. So things are extremely difficult for Ukraine.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Israeli forces say they've killed 14 Palestinian fighters in a raid in a refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank. Tensions remain high across the region after a series of retaliatory strikes between Israel and Iran. Our correspondent Wira Davis reports from Jerusalem.
At times over the last few weeks, a regional conflict between Israel and Iran seemed a distinct possibility, with both sides directly attacking each other's territory. But some of that tension eased this weekend as Iranian and Israeli leaders appeared to either downplay the severity of the crisis or decline to mention it at all. But an overnight attack on a pro-Iranian military base in Iraq is a timely reminder that Iran's allies are present across the region, either through Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis in Yemen, or militias in Iraq and Syria. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. The Pentagon denied any involvement. But images from the Khalso base near Baghdad showed buildings damaged by an explosion, which reportedly killed one person and injured several others. Tensions across the region remain high. In the occupied Palestinian West Bank, where there have been frequent clashes in recent weeks, an Israeli military operation in the Nur Shams refugee camp is reported to have killed at least 10 people, including a commander from the armed group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Palestinian sources said a child was among the dead. But it's to the ongoing war in Gaza that Israel's main focus has returned. There were overnight attacks by tanks and fighter jets in central and southern parts of the Strip. At the Najjar hospital in Rafah, parents and siblings consoled each other after several civilians, including children, were reported to have been killed in overnight airstrikes. Israel said it had attacked military infrastructure, compounds and armed terrorists. The United States and others have repeatedly urged Israel not to launch what is expected to be a major offensive in Rafah, warnings that seem to have little impact on Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel's Prime Minister has repeatedly said the offensive in Rafah must happen if Hamas is to be defeated and Israeli hostages released.
Wira Davis. In Iran itself, there have been reports that some are unhappy with their government's threats towards Israel, with people on Persian language X or Twitter even calling the Revolutionary Guard terrorists. Now the clerical regime appears to be trying to reassert its authority with a renewed crackdown by the morality police. Param Gabadi from the BBC's Persian service has been looking at videos of the morality police at work.
It's really amazing that on the very same day that Iran attacked Israel, hours before that, it deployed massive number of police, morality police, on the streets of Tehran, and they began a campaign called Light in order to crack down on women who are not wearing, observing their hijab, who are not wearing their headscarf. So we've seen videos of women being violently arrested, beaten, and forced into police vans. In one video that shocked the nation, we see a woman who is, after a confrontation with the morality police, she falls down and she has a seizure. She has a fit of seizure. And that was really shocking because she's there, like, you know, shaking all over the floor. And apart from that, we see that university students are also barred from entering the campuses because they have not observed the hijab. But we also managed to talk to some people inside Iran. One of them told me that in the Morality police station, many women were telling police officers that you do not dare fight Israelis. That's why you've started, cracking down on us women. But I also managed to, talk to a woman who shared her experience when she was beaten up, that we can have a listen.
A big male officer kicked me very hard in the back. Later, I began urinating blood. The doctor told me my kidney was partly torn. The court fined me $50. The judge warned me that if I am detained again, I will go to prison and will be banned from traveling abroad.
Now, this comes as I've been reading that some in Iran are not happy with the bellicose attitude towards Israel, saying fix things at home first. I mean, is this campaign by the Morality Police, as well as Iran's attacks on Israel, is that all linked?
So I talked to many Iranian experts, analysts, Iranian women rights activists. They all unanimously think that the both are linked. Iran is using this iron fist crackdown to show that you cannot revolt again. Because as you remember, 2 years ago, after the death of the Kurdish girl Mahsa Amini, protests swept the country over hijab. Now, this is a huge gamble for Iranian authorities to again start a crackdown on women over hijab. But all the analysts agree that this is in order to intimidate people, that if Iran is attacked by Israel, if it's weakened by Israel, people do not dare to come onto the streets and revolt.
Param Gabadi from BBC Persian talking to Oliver Conway. Still to come.
I feel like I've lost community, something that was so pivotal to my tech journey.
A major international organization supporting women in tech runs out of cash and closes down.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Officials in the Central African Republic say almost 60 people have died in a boat accident on the Mpoko River near the capital Bangui. Most of the 300 passengers on the overcrowded ferry were travelling to attend a funeral. A video of the incident has been posted online, as Julian Bedford reports.
The footage is dramatic. The boat sets off, packed with mourners, dangerously low in the water. All of a sudden, people start jumping off the vessel, which appears to collapse or disintegrate rather than capsize. Onlookers, including those in small boats, are frozen for seconds before rushing to the aid of those now in the water. That so many drowned so close to the riverbanks is probably due to the numbers dragged down as the boat submerges. Some of the victims may not have been able to swim.
Julian Bedford with that report. Last year, the Canary Islands hosted more than 16 million tourists. But many of the Spanish archipelago's residents have now had enough. Under the banner, "The Canaries Have a Limit," thousands of protesters have taken to the streets demanding a rethink on what they call an unsustainable tourism model. Lydia Morales took part in the demonstrations.
The major problem is the model of massive tourism that is since decades, and it's just destroying the island indeed and the life of the residents here. We are feeling we're being pushed away. Our priorities are not taken in consideration. It's actually, this is a complaint towards to the politicians. Their priorities are more focused on making constructions towards a tourism complex and hotels next to a natural environment.
So what are the key issues? Cleo O'Flynn is a freelance journalist in Tenerife.
Like you just heard from your interviewee there, the main thing is that there is a sense that over-tourism or a tourism boom has pushed locals out of their own homes, in a sense. And housing is one of the major issues, in fact, because what has happened with overbuilding in certain areas is that price rises or rental rises, combined with, say, second holiday home buying by a lot of overseas buyers, have meant that people who work in the tourism sector can't afford to live there anymore. And that is kind of causing a domino effect because people have to travel to work. They're having problems getting to work. Their families are living further and further away from centres. So there is a sense that in some parts of the island, there needs to be a radical rethink of how tourism is structured, is managed and is sold.
There is talk of imposing a tourism tax. Is that going to happen? How would it work?
I think it might be considered. What's interesting today, up until now, there was very little noise from any of the political parties. But there was a much bigger turnout, I think, than people imagined. The government say 32,000 in Tenerife. Organisers say 80,000. Either way, it was far beyond expectations. And already this afternoon, a spokesperson for the governing party at regional level have said, let's sit down together. Let's see what tomorrow brings. So I think they need to start looking at how to, I suppose, control more licensing for resort developments and very much how to look at rent controls and making more units, apartment blocks available for rental, residential rental let rather than holiday buys and holiday lets. Because at the moment, as I say, you have swathes are certain pockets in tourist areas where the vast majority now would be overseas holidaymakers rather than local Canarians. And local Canarians includes people like me and a lot of foreign residents who've made this place their home.
Freelance journalist Cleo O'Flynn in Tenerife. One of London's best-known arts institutions was built on what was once the hub of the capital's textiles or rag trade after the area was virtually obliterated by World War II bombing. The Barbican is a bold, imposing, austere-looking concrete building, and usually it's very grey. But at the moment, it's a sea of vivid pink, and the front is covered in cloth. Penny Dale has been down to the Riverside Terrace to find out what it's all about.
When you come from that side, wow, what is it?
I love the colours and the shapes. They look a bit like wrapped up sweets. So it's very impressive, the size.
I think it's awful. It looks a bit like a mess to me.
What's provoking those different reactions is an artwork called Purple Hibiscus. To me, it's actually a little bit more pink than purple. It's huge, 2,000 square metres of cotton cloth, hand-woven and hand-stitched together in Ghana and then draped over the Barbican Centre here in central London. Sewn on top of the fabric is about 130 traditional garments. They're green, blue, orange, and some of them are inside out, so you can actually see the yellowish stain of sweat from the person who wore them. They're from northern Ghana, and so is the artist who created Purple Hibiscus.
My name is Ibrahim Mahama. I'm a visual artist from Tamale. In Ghana, we call it the Batakari. They wear it over a long period of time, and then they pass it on from one generation to the other. So what I do is that I engage with my collaborators and communities. I'll give them new smocks in exchange for the old ones, because my work is mostly born out of failure and decay. When a material is stained, it is somehow imbued with the ghosts and also like these spirits of history. I always think that that's when it's beginning to live more, because it contains history within it.
Ibrahim says that some Ghanaians don't just hand over their batakaris because it can feel as if they're abandoning the memories of the family. Instead, they go through a ritual and they often put a bit of urine on the garments, because they believe that that can release the souls of their ancestors from the material. So how did the artist put together such an enormous piece of art?
It was quite extraordinary to test what it means to be able to take a traditional form like this and blow it into something very contemporary. I thought, why not use a stadium? We worked with over 1,000 people. So imagine all these people sitting on the material, sewing, like the labour that is going into it. And the Barbican basically was built with a lot of labour. After the concrete was cast, the men, they had to chip off the surface of the concrete in order to get the texture of the building. So I thought, what could be more beautiful than creating this relationship between these two labour forms?
Not everyone is a fan of the art, and some say it's nothing new. The husband and wife team of Christo and Jean-Claude famously wrapped a set of islands off Miami back in the 1980s. But Shanae Javeri, the head of visual arts at the Barbican Centre, defends the exhibit.
Ibrahim has acknowledged their influence on his work. So, of course, when they started to wrap islands and monuments of great power, it was striking, and the geopolitical, social conditions in which they did it were different. And also their intentions were different. And I think the quality of the work that Ibrahim has done, the hand-finished nature of it, the strong community and democratic aspect of it, is something that's quite specific to him. But it shares in a visual language and an act of draping and covering or wrapping that is familiar.
Sharna Gaveri, the head of visual arts at London's Barbican Centre, ending that report by Penny Dale. It's emerged that despite testing positive for a banned substance, some Chinese swimmers were cleared to take part in the Tokyo Olympics 3 years ago. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has confirmed that 23 athletes had tested positive. About half of them went on to compete at the Games. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton has been following the story.
This all dates back, Alex, to a domestic Chinese swim meet that took place right at the end of 2020 and in the first few days of 2021. And it was a swim meet in the city of Shijiazhuang, meant to be sort of an internal trial to see which of China's top swimmers would be able to go on to compete in the Olympics. It was quite important. After that swim meet, the Chinese anti-doping agency got in touch with the World Anti-Doping Agency and said, we have found positive results in 23 of our top swimmers. They found very small amounts of a performance-enhancing drug called trimetazidine. And they said that they had done some investigations along with Chinese police and decided that these 23 swimmers had ingested the drug unwittingly. They said they'd found traces of the drug in the hotel kitchen where all the swimmers had been staying for this meet. And because of this, they had decided that this was unintentional. Now, what's key is that the World Anti-Doping Agency, A, decided to simply accept the Chinese findings. They didn't question them. They say that's because they had no credible evidence to the contrary. And also that all of this was conducted in secret. Nobody was told outside of these internal conversations that this was happening. And half of these athletes went on to actually compete at the Olympics and in some cases win medals.
I was going to say, a lot of them went on to win medals, didn't they? Should we read anything into that?
I will say that the Americans are very unhappy upon finding this news. They say that these swimmers should have at least been suspended, if not banned, from competing in internationally. They're also very upset that this was all done in secret and no one else was consulted.
Celia Hatton. In an increasingly digital world, coding, that's the language used to make computer programs, has never been more important. But for years, coding and the tech industry in general have been male-dominated areas. And now, one of the main organizations supporting female coders around the world has suddenly announced it will close. Ella Bicknell reports.
Women Who Code started in 2013 as a network in San Francisco for women tech engineers navigating a male-dominated industry. The movement grew, offering scholarships, conferences and online classes, with a community now spanning 360,000 people across 145 countries. Or at least it did. A shock statement on its website has announced that it will close due to a lack of money. People have taken to social media to express concerns that an invaluable resource might be going.
A lot of women in tech are really concerned as well about the ripple effect of this. When I was getting into tech, Women Who Code was one of the first organisations I came across after Code First Girls here in the UK and so many others. But Women Who Code was the largest.
That's Jennifer Opal, founder of Data But Make It Human, a company trying to improve diversity in tech.
I feel like I've lost community, something that was so pivotal to my tech journey.
Emma Rogers is a junior programmer for Sumo Digital, a UK-based video game developer. She was studying fashion design when her university offered her the opportunity to learn how to code.
if there's no opportunity and it's not out there, then people like me who didn't consider it a first choice because I'd have never thought, oh, that might be something I can get into, even though it turns out I really enjoy it and I'm quite good at it. How are we ever going to get women into those senior positions, into those CEO positions within coding if that funding's taken away?
According to the careers platform Zipier, women represent about 34% of the workforce in large US tech companies. It's why outreach organisations like Women Who Code were set up with the aim of evening out those numbers. But it seems there's little investment. Perhaps it's a sign of the times. The tech industry has been cutting back in general in recent months, with layoffs across the sector from X to Google.
Ella Bicknell. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Philip Bull, and the producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Kun lapsi syntyy, syntyy myös vanhempi. Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka, kolmen lapsen äiti, ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.